Welcome to the Intuitive Awakening Podcast. I'm your host, Deanna Riddick. I'm an author, teacher, and eternal seeker of truth. I am on a mission to spread metaphysical knowledge to help you awaken your spirit. If you want to learn how to open the door to your divine self, you are in the right place. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Intuitive Awakening. Thank you for joining me for this week's episode. We have a lovely guest today. Sharon Yarborough is joining us. Sharon has spent a lifetime, I think, reflecting on the nature of existence, shaped early on by a strict Southern Baptist upbringing that I assume left you questioning doctrines of exclusion and even eternal damnation. So she is the author of The Land of the Dancing Rabbits, which is what we're here to talk about today. I'm really excited, Sharon, to hear about your history and what led you to write this book, so on and so forth. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here, Deanna.
So I would love to hear a little bit more before we get started in regards to your book about your upbringing, because obviously, you know, a very strict Southern Baptist upbringing, I think, is in deep contrast to the content of your book.
Yes, it is. First thing out, let me reassure everyone, I had a very lovely childhood. My parents really were very lovely and loving people. The environment was not that encouraging of free thinking, shall we say. You could think as freely as you would like, as long as it fit within a certain, you know, constricted, right, you know, between this wall and this wall, and stay there. And as long as you stayed there, then everything was okay, and we loved you, and things were fine, and life is going to be good. And then, of course, one grows up and starts seeing a few things that, you know, this doesn't really jive with what I'm seeing in the world and what I'm seeing of people around me. So I began to ask some serious questions, and that didn't go over too well. So I decided to take my own spiritual journey, my spiritual questioning, underground. That was the safest way for me to deal with it. So I continued to get on very well with family, with the people that I knew at the church. Eventually, I did fall away from the church in my mid-teens, early 20s. So I stopped going there, which was a bit of an adjustment to make, because much of my social interaction was with those people in that church environment. But I was moving out into college and then work. So those avenues were opening up for me for, a whole world of experience, you know, and different attitudes and how people thought. But still, I wasn't finding my tribe. Shall we say, of folks that were really to ask hard questions. I mean, the really hard questions about how the world did its thing, you know, how it worked, what we were here for. Folks would rather just, you know, meet you at the bar after work, that kind of thing, which you did. I mean, don't misunderstand me. But at any rate, it was difficult to talk to folks about the things that I was thinking about, exploring. I didn't have a lot of answers. So I was looking for somebody or someone's to share that kind of stuff with, to bounce those ideas off of, and was not finding it. So I continued to live with this underground for a long time. And finally, it wanted out. So in the late, very late 90s, and of course, now I'm getting on in years, very late 90s, I had this notion to start writing. And so I wrote one. I took a writing course with a man named Tom Bird, who was doing a what they called Evenings at Emory. Emory University was sponsoring a continuing education program. And so he would come in from Sedona and teach these courses on writing. And he had an interesting approach. The notion of sitting down to write 2 hours and write as fast as you possibly can. That kind of gives the that yada yada. Oh, you can't write a book. What do you think you're doing writing a book? You don't know anything about this. That kind of attitude, you know, that thinking, it gives that critic a chance to hush up. He just doesn't get a chance to get a word in edgewise since you're writing so fast. And that's how I got the book out, the initial copy, the version of the book. And then it sat. I went on with life and work and everything. I go back to it periodically, tinker with it. And then at one point, I started to tinker and I said, no, this is not right. This isn't right. I don't believe this stuff anymore. So I had matured by leap years since I'd written the first draft and then what I had now. So I took it up again and I started slashing and burning and cut it down from, it had been almost 200,000 words when I started with. And so the final version here is like 155,000. So that's a lot of material to whack out. But I was much happier with what came out because it was a different me that was listening and hearing different aspects of my own journey over those years and how I had matured, things that I didn't believe anymore, kind of, okay, we're just not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about these things over here. So that's kind of how the book came to be what it is today. But, and it is self-published, which is an interesting journey of its own, let me tell you.
I understand completely. I'm wondering, throughout your life, even after like writing the initial draft, what were the some of the, I guess, top three things, like just from your own upbringing that real that you were really questioning, that you were really seeking to understand?
Why was God necessarily out there and I was here? Explain to me that gulf. That bothered me in a big way, particularly since I was told that God is infinite. Well, if you define infinity, that kind of includes everything, right? And that would include me. So you can't have God out there and me here being separate. Because you can't be outside of infinity. It just doesn't work like that. But people around me, particularly the adults, were very uncomfortable with that question. That did not go well. Another one was, of course, the difference in the notion of the Old Testament angry sky god, always ready to throw whatever at people for, I don't know, crossing him or whatever it was. And then the Jesus figure, who was just total love and acceptance and forgiveness and whatever, and that just didn't, and yet he would call God Father. I couldn't reconcile those two personages. So I had greater trust in the Jesus person than I did in this thing that I was being told was God. So that was another one. A third one. Other people's way. Why were they necessarily the wrong way? And maybe even more fundamental to that, is there truly only one true way to make your way back to God? Again, we're talking about that gulf that I was questioning. But there are awful lot of people on the planet with an awful lot of different ideas about their approach and their relationship with Source. Or whatever else it is you want to call it. Why should there be only one? I was thinking in an infinite source, wouldn't be that boring. Quite frankly, wouldn't be that boring. There's only one way. So I guess those were three. There were others, but yeah, that was a good question. I never thought to pin those down. Yeah.
Definitely,
More
because
good questions.
there's some, very in your book, there's some, I think, really big concepts that you tackle through this conversation with the main character and the bear. So I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind just very quickly giving us kind of the audience like a synopsis of your book.
Oh, goodness. Okay. This is going to be, believe it or not, this is a challenge because I have to go back and reread the book to remind myself what they talk about. If you get to it, we might talk about how it was written, but at any rate, yeah, what happens? The primary character, Harlan Wilder, he's past middle age. He's a late baby boomer, angry man, southerner. He's on a motorcycle and hits black ice in the North Georgia mountains during a late spring freeze, which happens here in the South. Anyway, slides off the mountain and winds up damaging himself somewhat and decides not to try to crawl back up the mountain, but to head down. And in the process, stumbles upon this bear, and she flat out surprises him by speaking to him. And so they strike up this rather tentative relationship, tentative because she doesn't cut him any slack as far as taking apart some of his self-delusions about his life and people around him and the world around him and how life goes and reality itself. So anyway, they begin this trek across the hills. He thinks they're going back to, quote, civilization. He's hopeful of that because he's tired of listening to this bear and tired of walking around behind her. But she begins to pick apart some of his assumptions about things. I'm dodging things because there's a spoiler if I.
Yeah, I completely understand. Well, without spoiling, I do have, several questions I certainly wanted to look at today and some of the concepts that you do discuss. And one of them, kind of early on in the book when they're conversing back and forth, she does ask your main character, or she states to your main character, that it's assumptions in life that keep you from recognizing other possibilities. So, for example, all your life you made assumptions based on what other people told you or how they treated you, which is something I think kind of recurs a little bit throughout, the book. And I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit on what this means and how this kind of impacts everybody, like in their lives.
Oh, goodness, yes. This little thing we have that's called ego. It was a shock to me early on when I discovered that it's simply a mental construct. I thought ego was me, that thing that talked to me in my head and all that to do. Including the personality, this thing that said, "Oh, you're a good girl. You do this, which is correct. You go to this church. You're a Christian. You're a Baptist." Keep stacking on top of that all of those labels, all of those definitions that not only friends and family, your spiritual tradition that you're involved in, your work life, everything that. We do this to one another. We lay these labels on each other because we see that as how you function in the world. That's your role, whatever. But then we forget they are roles, and we begin to believe that really is what we are. That is who we are. I am that parent. I am that child. I am that citizen or whatever, that political party. I am that. Well, we're a little bit more than that, but. What the book attempts to get to is expanding the possibilities that maybe you're something more than that, because we all, I think if we have an iota of self-awareness, at some point we become dissatisfied with those roles, with being that person that other people have told us we are. And we just want to more know. We want to know more. And that's what I tend to do with the book, is just help to pick away at those assumptions that what people have told me means that's what I am. I assumed that for a long, long time, but then, oh, maybe not. Maybe there are other options. I could do so. Maybe I am something bigger. And I, of course, with the reading that I have done, my own spiritual path, that kind of put me in that direction of, ooh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want something else, something much bigger, something that I had no imagination at the time to even well, that's redundant, imagination to imagine that I could actually be this an infinite and unlimited thing that is of this infinite unlimited source. So I'm still trying to wrap my head around that.
Yes, I
It
think
may
you're
be
right.
hitting. It doesn't
We all
wrap.
are.
Doesn't wrap. It can only do little things. It's not quite geared to handle that infinity stuff.
Yes, I think we're all still trying to. I mean, from my perspective, while you may gain this understanding that, we're a part of the infinite, what does that truly mean? That's a big question, and I don't know that we know 100% the answer until we depart, this place.
But
So
see, there, I think it's all the different. I'll use the word story. We tell ourselves stories, and it is a way of knowing. It's a way of making sense of the world. It's a way of entertaining ourselves, obviously, in the classic sense of what a story is. But we have an American story, the notion of our history. There are other stories. I even think science tells stories. Not in the sense like where I grew up, if you got caught telling a story, that meant you were lying about something. But no, story, which means I have characters and metaphors and whatever, they're working together to explain something, to explain what's happening in the world. And I think even our religions are doing the same thing. They're using metaphors to try to get at something that's much, much bigger that brains simply can't focus on head on. We need stories. We need the metaphors. It's kind of like this. And I think that Harlan does in the book encounter an old Zen image of where a hand pointing to the moon. You don't pay attention to the hand. It's the moon. That's the truth out there. That's what it's po pointing to. So in a way, that hand pointing is kind of like our stories. So where I was going with that is, I can chase a rabbit. Yep, I can chase a rabbit.
So, I guess kind of in alignment with this, also in your book, there's a section where they're talking about the fact that, thoughts are going to happen in life. Like we all have thoughts, right? But if they go unexamined, you never notice how they're colored by these deeply held beliefs that we don't even know that we have in life. So can you talk maybe about, I don't know, a moment in your life
Life.
when you discovered like one of these hidden beliefs? Like how did that realization change you?
Oh yeah. I'll go back to that one about God being out there and me being here. That epiphany when I saw that an unacknowledged suppression of the idea of what infinity really means. Now, either God or Source wasn't infinite. Which then could support the idea that there was a separation, a boundary between myself and it, or we just weren't making sense to ourselves. Owning up to the real definition of what that infinite definition is, where God must contain us, we cannot be separate from that. Therefore, we cannot be lost in sin. And that includes everybody. Everybody is in there. Even the people that we think are, oh, they're just terrible, dreadful, dastardly people. We wouldn't want to have them around us at all. They're all part of it too. It's all source. It's all divine. And as I started chasing all those implications, that's where I kind of went, oh, I'm going to spend some time with this. That's one of those, yeah.
I wonder
Help.
for you, throughout this kind of discovery journey, how did, and again, I don't know a lot about your personal family, but how did this impact, I guess, your relationship with your family in a sense that I assume throughout this journey you had so many, deviations when it came to exploring like other ways of being, other paths of believing, other spiritualities on the planet, certainly in contrast to what you grew up with.
I just, as I mentioned, went underground. I didn't talk about it. I didn't talk about books I was reading. I did by that time I was out of the house, so nobody was snooping through stuff in my bedroom. But on occasion, we'd have conversations. My father, particularly, he was a thinker, but he was of that generation that, and I guess that indoctrination that you just couldn't, you went just so far with the questions you were asking. Other than that, you would wind up questioning your faith, and that was a no. Don't do that. No, don't go there. And he had great concern, and mother too, great concerns for me because I wasn't in the church. If I was in the church, then they would feel better about it. I was safe. I was, over there in the church. So that was a source of distress for them. But I wasn't. After a point, I guess they figured, okay, she's an adult. I can't do anything about it anymore. And the fact that I didn't rub their noses in it. The fact that I was going over here and reading about Buddhism, or hear Kabbalah, or you name it. I didn't talk about that stuff, so they didn't have anything to respond to other than my absence from the church.
Yes, I mean, it's certainly, I think if you come from that type of background, which is similar to the background that I, grew up with as well, there is certainly this huge level, at least I can only speak for myself, of discomfort because, there is fear for your life. Fear for your afterlife, fear, you know what I mean? Fear.
Yeah, exactly.
A huge fear, and they're so worried for you. And I think it comes from love,
It does. It
even
does.
though, you do have very differing belief systems.
Yeah. And that is unfortunately one of those assumptions that creates that kind of distress, the idea that if you don't do these things, then God is going to be unhappy and you will suffer. For whatever, and you don't question that because somebody said this and somebody else interpreted it in another way. Because I don't know, whatever was written, there are a billion different interpretations. I mean, how many different varieties of, Christian Protestant, I can't say that word, Protestants. We have a lot of varieties of that, and then you've got Catholicism and its take on things, and so where's the one truth and all of that?
Exactly. Yes. There are so many, just within Christianity alone, like you said, so many different denominations, which means different interpretations. And it's very
But you know,
interesting when you grow
I've
up
come.
and you grow up in a particular denomination that denounces other denominations and so on and so
Oh
forth.
yeah, oh yeah. Oh, my sister really caught it for wanting to date a Catholic boy. Oh, that was.
That's funny.
But as I've grown, and thank goodness I have had access to a host of spiritual writers from all sorts of different traditions, that I've become more and more comfortable that God's not picky. If you're as long as you're paying attention, there's. And I'm here, and I want a relationship. I want you to be aware of what you are. Here I'm speaking like I'm Source.
No, it's fine. But no, I
Let me
think
turn that
that's I think that's very important. I mean, I think for everybody on this planet, like my personal goal has always been like, let's remember what we are. Because
Yes.
if we remember what we are, then we can understand, hopefully, why we're here, but also what truth actually is, right? There's no
Yes, it
need
does.
for us to like combat each other for things that are so inconsequential and meaningless. But I think that's why this type of work or type of examination of your reality and your worldview is really crucial in life in general.
Exactly. And it's, as I said, it's not a search for the one true path, but it's a true search, and a true and earnest desire to realize what we are and that relationship with what we are. Again, the words get so crazy because it's still that duality kind of talk. My relationship with that suggests there's something else out there to relate to, but it's kind of like the relationship that with that self that Again, it's duality. I can't make the words work.
No, I completely understand too, because it's like we have, I think, the intellectual understanding. We understand that we are all one and the same. Like there is no true separation, but I understand the language that you're using because it's kind of natural for us to speak that way. Another thing you talk about in your book, which I love, I know the Baronetti is talking to the main character, Harlan, and she says, as a human, you possess unlimited potential because you are unlimited potential. And what does this statement mean to you personally?
I'm made in the image of that source, according to biblical text. And that means I'm creative, wildly creative. And out of that field of creativity, well, that creativity pulls from some larger field, well, the field of source, whatever it is that I choose to create or earnestly desire to create. It all exists out there as pure potentiality. We've got, and I can't quote it, but there are quantum physical theories that talk about potentiality out there, and it's that we actually collapse a potential into, quote, reality or into the physical when we observe it. And that's old physics. That's 100 years old now by now, but we're just starting to pay attention to it. But that I think that gets to our unlimited nature. If we are pure potential, then that means that opens the gate for anything. Anything, anywhere, anytime, outside of time. We are huge beings, huge beings.
Yes, we are. So,
I get into that space and my heart starts going pitter-pat, pitter-pat.
I think, we kind of live in this world that really emphasizes limitation and fear. So, how do you think that, like, the readers of your book or the audience in general can begin to reconnect with this sense of their unlimited potential?
Unlimited potential. Meditation helps, and I say that as one who is not a regular meditator. But I have heard, witnessed from, and read enough accounts of folks who have had profound experiences meditating, where you get quiet enough so that you can hear. And it's not really hearing, it's a different kind of communication. There's an upwelling of knowingness from your very core that will provide guidance in one direction or another. And that I think is how we begin to understand what that enormous thing is that is ourself. That personality, the little chatter box, that's always commenting, that the dancing rabbits, they finally calm down, and then something meaningful has a chance to arise and to catch your attention so that you pay attention and listen. And again, listen, that's not the right word, but it's the other ears that you're listening with.
I think for and I probably say this so many times when I speak to people, but I'm always very curious about this because I think, as we were talking about in life, you are not for the I can't speak for the entire world, but I can say that many people are raised in a way that they are told that they can only accomplish A, B, and C. Like certain things are off the table for you. You only have access to this, and therefore you shouldn't aim higher, right? So we believe that, and that's reflected in our reality, and that's what we accept to be true because our reality is mirroring what we actually believe in, right? So what would you say to people who just have such a tough time with that? Because it's very difficult for us to get past the stories that we tell ourselves, but those stories come from usually from our parents and then from the environment and so on and so forth. So if somebody were to sit down and meditate to try to, listen, if you will, to something else that wants to share a completely different point of view about you that's in, again, that very much so deviates from what you've been told for, let's say 40, 50 years, right? Because it's usually, not always, but usually much later in life where you start to really question so much about what's happening because you're so unhappy. But what would you say to people if they even question that inner voice telling them that the stories that you've been told are not a true reflection of who you are?
And it's the stories telling you not to believe that inner voice that's coming to the fore. First steps might, for someone who is in that position, where I was in that position of don't go there because bad things will happen. Don't question that. You're going to find yourself, first of all, you can't force it. You're going to have, you may or may not realize that you have questions. And something doesn't feel right anymore. There's something about those stories that just, and I'm not necessarily talking about how the Bible is interpreted or whether it should be the Bible or the Quran or any other sacred text, but just that perspective of the world is not necessarily jiving with what you're observing. And when you start to ask questions, serious questions about that, I believe that desire to know the answer is heard by that ether, by that source stuff in which we live and move and have our being. And teachers arise. There's something that says, when the student's ready, the teacher comes or the teacher appears. I think that's very, very true. People, or maybe it's a work cohort. Someday at lunch, you just suddenly discover, hey, he wonders about the same thing that I do. Hey, he's asked this question, blah, 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 or they've done this thing. And little things start to happen in your life if you're paying attention to it. And you've got a little bit of gumption to say, let me step outside, the confines of this little cage that I've grown up in, and I've basically allowed myself to live in. Let me see what's out here. See what this person has to say. And if you trust that person, that may be a line to follow. If there's something in your gut will tell you whether or not it makes sense for you or not. And maybe that thing won't make sense for you until another 10 or 15 years down the road. I had some instances like that where certain teachings in certain spiritual traditions, I said, can't handle that one right now. But later on, as my understanding began to mature in other areas, I started to see, oh, now I see the wisdom in what they were talking about there. Now I understand that. The Buddhist idea of, well, basically it's a non-theistic kind of a structure. I had difficulty envisioning source or God, that. Oh, I'm losing the word. I wanted that personal, warm, fuzzy, caretaking, kind of enveloping sort of idea that I had grown up with. As a child, I was taught that was what God was. Now he gets mad, but there was this enveloping thing. And the
Yes,
Buddhist
very.
notion of it just being more of a dispassionate and non-personal thing. I couldn't jive with that. Now I'm okay with it, because it just make it, well, I'm okay with it. What else can I say about it? And in fact, I kind of lean more toward it, than I do the warm, fuzzy, whatever. But we're made in so many different ways just from the potential of potentiality. There's just so much variety of ways of being in the world. And that, I think, the exploration of those ways of being is really what we're here to do. Expressing that creativity that we have, that we are,
Yes, and
which
I think
makes life so much more interesting.
it does make things very interesting. I was like, why would you want something that is just straight uniformity? What could you even learn from that? Nothing.
And you don't want to be uniform because what you are is much bigger than that. And it begins to chafe. After a while, it lets out of that collar, just so get rid of the collar so I can run free.
Yes, and something that you said, which I was talking to somebody about like last week, was the idea of if we were talking, source, and we don't use the word God because there's so much baggage with the word God, right? But when you say source, just that word itself feels very impersonal.
Does.
Very
It does.
disconnected from us as a human being, because God itself is a humanized version. It's the
Right.
human's version of what it is, but really that's such a
Right.
tiny thought, right? Outdated, very, very outdated thought. But it's the thought that many, I would say, is, I think, the dominant consciousness on this planet at this time, even though I do think it is shifting. I still think it reigns supreme.
And I think there's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's just give God a chance to let him out of the box. And I said him, and I was okay. Just let God out of the box, because we have it within our power. And I think folks who still do ascribe to that, this is God and this is me and that sort of thing. I cannot believe that they do not have experiences. The taste of that experience of that infinite, whatever it is, that lives and moves within us and around us and whatever we experience that in certain ways and at certain times in more powerful ways than in others, perhaps. It just comes dressed up differently,
Yes, I totally agree. And like you said, I like that you said, let him out of the box, because if you allow God to be even bigger, greater, then you can even conceive, not just angry at man for not following a set of rules. I think, that allows you to have, I don't know, maybe even a greater appreciation of what source is, things that we can't even
Yes.
conceive.
Yes. And yeah. And we find out that it may be more interesting than we thought it was.
Yes, exactly that. I always think that in a personal sense, like, I wonder what else is going on up there, out there.
I tell you, there is a sense of humor.
Yes.
There is definitely a sense of humor. I don't know if we have time. I'll tell you this little story.
Sure, go for it.
Okay, I refer to them as angels. Maybe I don't know if there's a hierarchy. I don't know any of that kind of stuff. But at any rate, angel was a happy word, and I could glow on the idea of angel. But at any rate, I realized finally it dawned on me that I do have angels or helpers or whatever name you want to put them that surround me, that help me and keep me out of hot water and keep me safe even when I don't have the wit to do that, to know that I'm in trouble. But I was on the road, interstate here in Atlanta, heading a good way south, to see my sister was in an assisted living facility at the time. So I was driving down there to see her, and there were traffic was nuts. Atlanta traffic is just insane. Semis that look like I don't know, giant things. And I drive this little bitty Civic, so here I am with these walls of semi trucks on either side. I mean, zoom, 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 zoom. And I'm starting to freak. And so I'm going, oh, I named my angel too. I call him Roger. Don't ask me why Roger came up. I said, oh, Roger, get me out of this, get these crazy people out of my face, or I'm just gonna lose it. Well, within like a minute or so, they started peeling off one exit here, another exit here, another exit. The crazy people that were riding my bumper zoomed around and went on off. And I'm starting to breathe a little bit easier. And I look to my right, and here comes a burgundy passenger van kind of a thing. And the company name is emblazoned on the side, and it says Rogers Transportation Services.
Oh my God, I love when that happens.
I laughed, I laughed, and I laughed, and I laughed. It was great. It was great.
That's fantastic. I
It was
love when
Roger.
things like that happen.
Okay. And they're there and they're paying attention to you. Now, is that source? I think it's definitely of source. I mean, it's certainly not something outside of source. Can't not be. But it's definitely present. And in a way, that related to me in a very personal way, because they knew my story. They knew I was using the word Roger. I say they. So I think, yeah, there's a sense of humor, and that is personal. And there is the love there, and that is incredibly personal.
Yes.
So it may not be a being, as we're taught in Christianity, it's referred to it as a being. And the Buddhists say, no, there's not a being, it just is what it is. But there is personal, we can relate to it. We can know it. And there are aspects of us that we share with it. Love.
Yes.
The biggie, love.
100%. And in terms of aspects of it that are, that we are made up of as well, which is one last thing I'll bring up, or maybe two last things in your book. There's this part where, again, your main character is told that we create our reality. And I would love to, for you to talk a little bit more about this, because I think that this has really become mainstream now, especially since the book The Secret, et cetera. We all know this. We create our reality. We hear it everywhere. Manifest, just manifest easily, manifest. But I want to hear your thoughts about this.
I believe one of your earlier guests, darn, I don't remember her name. She had a lovely discussion about manifesting, and she had gotten into the whole that whole area of work is manifesting. And she mentioned Joe Dispenza. He's put the best language around that, I think, that anybody has. Oh, excuse me. We're always manifesting. We're always creating, whether we're aware of it or not. And I think our big challenge before us is to become aware what we are manifesting by the vibrations that we put out, which pretty much are driven by the emotions that we feel. But to also attitudes that we hold that can trigger those emotions, what we vibrate and put out as an energy, the universe or source is going to match that. And then you're going to see what you're vibrating, because you're out picturing that vibration into the world around you. And if we don't like what we see, we need to change our vibration, and we need to ratchet it up from, I don't know, fear and suspicion and jealousy and revenge and all the nasties, and just even if you can't make the leap to joy, which is a big jump, at least have an appreciation, or patience. Giving somebody an opportunity or whatever, just ratchet, 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 ratchet. And the more we put that out, the more we'll get that back. If I'm more patient, or feel more patient within myself, or patience with myself for one thing or another, I'm going to start seeing that in the world around me. There are going to be other people around me that are going to be showing me patience. Yeah, you get what you give.
Yes,
Yeah.
definitely.
That kind of boils it down to. I don't know
Yes.
who coined that, but I appreciate it.
I would like to ask you before you go, tell us the, why is the book called The Land of the Dancing Rabbits? Explain the title.
There is a place where the book is set in North Georgia. It's called Chistiyi, which is the Cherokee pronunciation for it, and I think the locals today call it Choestoy, Choestoe. In the original Cherokee, it was called the Rabbit Place, or Rabbit Town, something like that. Although there is nothing in the term, suggests dancing. Nobody's dancing in the Cherokee word, but white people kind of got onto the idea of dancing. That was cute. So that's kind of what it's that's what the area is referred to as the land of the dancing rabbits. In the context of the book, Nettie the bear uses the rabbit metaphor for our busy yakking brain, those distracting thoughts, those things that we've been told all of our lives. They just it, that inner voice that just keeps talking all the time. It's always got an opinion about something. It's got a criticism about you or somebody else. It's a distraction away from what you really are and what maybe you should really be about. So that's where the dancing rabbits come from, is you got to keep those rabbits in check.
Yes, definitely keeping your thoughts in check and questioning your thoughts that you have. And I don't think many people do sit down to question, like, again, their story.
And some of you just don't believe. Okay, keep yakking, but yak if you want to, but I'm not going to believe you. You
Well,
can't squash them.
Sharon, it was so great having you on. If somebody wants to connect with you or they want to get a copy of your book, where do they go?
Amazon, Barnes and Nobles, also my website, SharonEYarbrough.com. I'll give you a hint there that my publisher Balboa created that website, and it's heavy on the graphics, so the page takes forever to load. So if you're impatient like me, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, that's where it comes.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining all of us today, Sharon. It was wonderful.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much, Deanna, and blessings to you.
To you as well. Thank you, everybody.